You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Kristen Marting. Kristen, thanks so much for being with me today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Kristen, we're talking in February, at the end of February in 2021, and we're talking about your role as the founding artistic director at here and the work that you've done as artistic director and otherwise. So I guess to begin with, how we're going to talk about, you know, here, as I imagine, evolving throughout the pandemic and what's happening. But first, I feel like I should just ask, you know, how are you? You're in the city. It is sort of, I don't know, not quite peak pandemic coming down. How are things in that context?
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously I'm a very people-oriented person, being a theater maker and running a nonprofit arts organization for so many years. So it's been a very strange time to be in my home so much. But I certainly have gained some valuable lessons, which I'll take with me post-pandemic. And I think a lot of people have. So I think that it's created a context for introspection and for progression for people that is healthy, even in this circumstance that we all wish we weren't in. Yeah.
And so what are some of the lessons that you brought from this, since you mentioned that this year of pandemic now?
Well, I think that there, in addition to the pandemic, we've had the racial reckoning in our country, and people are really thinking differently about how they work and their humanity and their relationship to each other and how to move away from white supremacist structures and to move towards anti-racist structures and organizations. So I think there's just been a lot of thinking about the way that organizations are structured, the way nonprofits and theaters in particular are structured, and what are ways that we can make the massive changes that need to happen to create more equitable organizations. So I think all of that has informed a lot of the work that we've been doing. We were on the path doing a lot of equity and justice work before George Floyd's murder. Last May, we had been doing work for several years as a staff and as individual leaders of the organization. But I think that this has made the space for us to progress more rapidly with work that needed to, changes that needed to happen and things that needed to progress with being able to take the time to really focus on these things and not just keep being product-oriented. I think a lot of us pre-pandemic were so, especially New York City, so moving quickly from one thing to the next thing, and not taking always the time to look at the value of the thing that just happened and how to assess that and how to lift that further and how to take the lessons of it and bring it into the next thing. So I'm grateful to have that. I'm grateful to feel like I have more work-life balance than I had before. And in a post-pandemic world, I don't want to go back to the kind of rat race of pressure that I put myself under. I'm the leader of the organization. No one else is putting me under that pressure but myself, but I'm not going to put myself back in that place. I guess those are just a couple of examples. Yeah.
I'm so glad you mentioned those. You know, I was just listening to an interview. It was on Valentine's Day with a psychologist, Esther Perel.
She's amazing.
NPR.
I love her.
She's amazing, right? Right. So I do too. So they were saying to her, like, you know, so what about the pandemic, right? Is more divorce or what's going on? And she said, I think the pandemic has sped things up. So she said, you know, what are we doing with our lives, you know, like, and you touched on a number of these things just now, kind of what's important and in our relationships, you know, are we happy with what we have, or would we rather go because you know, we can't wait around any longer or something like that. And I thought that was such a powerful, I haven't heard quite that angle on it except in echoing in what you just said, which is a kind of there's a reckoning with what's going on socially and politically, but you're also talking about a personal reckoning, it sounds like, in terms of how you spend your time and what's important. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I'll just give one very concrete example. I just spent about 2 weeks making homemade Valentines for people and sending to them in their homes. That is something that I would have never thought I had the time to do in a pre-pandemic context, but it gave me so much joy and so much sending that love to people and then having people like text me or call me and be like, I loved your Valentine. It made me so happy. Like, so it's just, I think there are a lot of ways that we can have happiness and success and contentment, you know, in our lives. And that's great to have had the time and the space to discover other outlets for creativity and for connection.
I love that. I'd like to talk a little bit more about that examples, because we will talk about the kind of voluminous amount of work you've done with here, which is important, and of course the opposite in the sense of sending out Valentines. But can you tell me a little bit more about sending out the Valentines? Because that's a kind of a lovely gesture that's obviously sort of almost the antithesis of here. It's obviously in the creative spirit and connection, but it's also in intimate and not so kind of goal or material or event based, right?
Yeah. Well, you should have seen the Valentines. They were kind of experimental. They were all collages and cut out from magazines. And so they were very homemade.
So how was that experience? Tell me about making them, if you don't mind. I know this is not what we were talking about, essentially. We're going to talk about here. But I'm interested in that because that's a personal practice that I think speaks to who you are, but also the moment that we're in.
It was, each one probably took about an hour, and I would go through magazines and cut things out, and sometimes you would find things, you'd be like, oh, that might be good for later, and sometimes you, like, have the idea of the person, and you're thinking of a specific image for that person or a specific type of thing for that person, and so they were all, like, reflective of the people. Like, so each one probably took about an hour. Some of them took a little less time, but some of them took a little more. It was super fun to think, you're curating imagery for someone that you care about, you know? So.
I love that. And how was the reception? I mean, did it, because there's the process of you doing it. Then of course people receive these. Then.
Yeah, it was totally joyous. Some people called, some people texted, you know, some people took pictures of it and posted it on social media. Like, it was just a total mixture and pretty joyous and fun. It was the fun came back, you know, with each person receiving it. So
it does kind of highlight that notion. I mean, you said you like Esther Perel too. I'm a big fan of hers, but that makes sense to you too, that we were talking about like lessons learned or some things that have shifted, and one of them is this kind of reevaluation of how you spend your time?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think also that thinking about one of our programs, we've done a whole bunch of stuff during COVID, which we can get into in a minute, but one of the projects that we just started is a U.S. mail project called Artful Post. And so we invited five artists to create small 6x6 works in response to a theme. And we invited audience members who we called art mates to create the prompt for the artist's creation. And so the project is just starting. It's going in the mail tomorrow or maybe this afternoon. And so the packet will go to the first artist. They'll create something. Then that artist mails it to an audience member, the art mate, and they get it. And then they look at the art and they write a prompt for the next artist. And then they mail it to the next artist. So we're doing a series of three of those right now. So each one will have five artists and four art mates involved with each one. So it's a collaborative artwork, but each artist creates their own art, but it's all like thematically connected.
So tell me a little bit more about that, because I mean, I understand, you know, mail art, correspondence art. Is it relate to that? I don't see how, like, the whole thing works yet. This will be exhibited?
So we'll exhibit it at the end. So the packet gets sent back to us when it's been created, and when we reopen, we'll exhibit the 15 artworks that have been created. And the one theme is at the table, so that at the table together, that's one of the themes. So there are five artists creating on the theme at the table together, modified by the prompt from each art mate. So yeah, it's going to be super fun, and you can see it when we reopen.
That's exciting, and I'm glad you mentioned that, because that relates a little bit to the Valentine's in some way, doesn't it? So tell me how Here has changed. You've watched it over its, you know, kind of whole, you know, life. How do you see it evolving? Or maybe we should just talk about the change in the mission of Here, perhaps, because that sounds like what has changed also in the past year with social and political, you know, shifts and awarenesses. So I guess I'm asking, how has the mission of Here shifted? And you can use examples if you want from its founding until now.
Yeah, I mean, we have always been founded to be an inclusive community that invited artists from all disciplines, ethnicities, and backgrounds to work in our space. That's always been in our mission. We've always worked in all disciplines, theater, music, dance, puppetry, and media arts. We have always been interested in work that is adventurous or contemporary, you know, adventurous, kind of contemporary, relevant and resonant to our times, and to create a place where adventurous, you know, audience members and theater goers and art lovers will come and engage. We've always been very process oriented. Our core program, our signature program, is the Here Artist Residency Program, where we support between 10 and 12 artists at a time over a long 2 to 3 year development process. And that process is tailored to each of those individual artists. They're not on the same train where they have to do things at the same time. And we support each artist from inception of the idea through work in progress, workshop, and then we fully premiere the work and help launch it on tour. Those artists, they don't come to us like a traditional theater where they've already got their script or they've already got the music written. They come to us just with the idea, and we support them through the birthing of the project. That's the core of what we do and what we've done. We've had that residency program for over 20 years now. It's probably coming up on 22 years or 21 years. When we first started the program, it was like we gave them $100 a month or something, and it wasn't connected to a production. It was connected to development. But that program has grown to be quite a robust program, and now when we select artists for the program, it's a $100,000 commitment to them and their work. $50,000 in cash and $50,000 in space, equipment, and services from the staff. So it's a substantial commitment to an artist that we're making, and the artist has control of those funds and how those funds are spent and expended over the arc of their project. And we partner with the artist to raise the rest of the money needed, because most of the projects are at a higher level budget-wise than the $100,000 that we're committing. The projects are often anywhere between $150,000 and $250,000. So we have more money to raise, but we're making that initial commitment to the work. We also have local artists work in our space through our sublet series program, which is a program that is a subsidized, curated rental program. So they're producing their own work, and we're a presenting venue of their work, but we provide some staff support, such as box office, some marketing support, some technical support. But we're not involved creatively in those projects. We're just supporters of those projects. And then we have our Dream Music Puppetry Program, which works with puppeteers that are local and international. And we bring a couple of those artists in each year for short presenting engagements. And it's adult puppetry, not puppetry for kids usually. It's usually adult-focused. So we have that range of programs. All of those programs obviously couldn't function the same way as soon as COVID happened. And so when we shut down on March 12th, we had no idea how long it would be for. and we decided that we were going to launch programming. I felt two things. Every artist I knew had lost every gig that they had, and they were completely panicked about how they were going to make any money. And I also felt like most audience members that I knew were completely panicked about what was going on in the world and where we were all going to be. And I just feel like when you're in a situation like that, you want to hear from artists, that artists are people that help us cope and help us understand how to grapple with what our world is. And so I felt like we needed to find a way to create programming that would connect, get artists paid, and connect audiences and artists so that they could be in dialogue with each other in such a stressful time and such an uncertain time. So we launched three programs on March 16th. One of them was like the simple, like, we're going to play archival videos and we'll get the artists to be there, and the artists and the audiences can talk with each other while they watch the archival videos. And we called that Here at Home. We ended up doing 18 of those. At first we did it weekly, and then we shifted it to monthly, and we've now phased it out. But that was something that we knew we could make happen right away. The first thing we showed was the show that had just gotten canceled, that we had a video document of, so that people could get exposed to that special work, that these artists had come from France, these wonderful puppeteers had come from France to do this piece. We got to do one performance, and then we had to shut down. We also started a series called Still Here, which was at first, you know, it was weekly, like artist musings, artists sharing something new they'd written, or reading that book of poetry, a piece of poetry that was meaningful to them, or just having dialogue with each other. And we were doing those. We were doing community posts. So we were paying artists for everything. If we showed the archival video, we paid them $50 in royalties for every person that was involved. So that sometimes would be 10 people, sometimes it'd be 25 people. When they did community posts, we paid them $40 for every community post. When they did an artist talk, we'd pay them a couple $100. So we just really made our commitment to getting artists paid. The third series we started was called Co-Video, and it was kind of like an exquisite corpse. It was thematic. It would be like social distancing, and you would create, each artist would create 10 seconds, and there was a common prop. So like the first one was social distancing, and the prop was gloves. And so the first artist creates 10 seconds, and the last frame of their video should match the first frame of the next artist's video. And so the handoff happens like that. It would be like a minute and a half or 2 minutes long. And they were super fun with 10 artists and a composer. So we did those.
And of course,
for a while.
This is a way to remotely collaborate, essentially. All this is happening remotely.
Yeah, exactly. Remote collaboration. So we would email the next chunk to each chunk to the next artist. They could see what had come before. So that was the range of programming that we launched on March 16th. We've done like a huge amount. And then, of course, it shifted to now artists were ready to create digital premieres. So we started doing digital premieres of new works that were written for this media. I wasn't so interested in doing readings or things that were not intended for the forum. I was much more interested in what do you want to make right now that speaks to this moment, and what are the resources that you need to support that. So we did larger $5,000 and $10,000 commissions to artists to create work for this time and this moment. And then in July, we started to do in real life, socially distanced outdoor stuff as a next step. And we've continued with that. The first piece that we did was this beautiful sound walk that Gelsie Bell and Joe White created for Greenwood Cemetery. And so people could go on their own and do this sound walk on their own time. They could go alone. They could go with someone. And the sound walk was about a 55-minute experience through Greenwood, which is an extraordinary park and cemetery, and had a lot of history and a lot of introspection and was very moving. And so that was the first, and we've done a series of sound walks and other installation experiences in outdoor space that are have been safe for New Yorkers since then.
It's so interesting because this is, you know, how, you know, that change in medium obviously is how the arts can and have adapted to this environment. When you talked about just before that walk, commissioning works that were, you know, designed for this, you know, not just read or interpreted. Can you give me one example of one of those works that you felt took advantage of writing well for this, you know, what the intention was, as opposed to just transferring something previous onto, you know, an easily accessed online medium?
Yeah, I mean, well, I thought that Gelsey's writing was really strong on Cairns, the piece for Greenwood Cemetery, and very thoughtful of deaths that have happened and of deaths that might be to come. And it was very bittersweet and uplifting at the same time. And I thought she did a beautiful job of capturing, like, the kind of emotional vulnerability of this moment where we all are. I also think that, like, Rob Hansel was a collaborator on a piece that I directed called Only You Will Recognize the Signal. He was the librettist. Kamala Shankaran was the composer, and I directed the piece. That piece was about these people that are on a ship that is traveling to a new location, and they're supposed to be sleeping, but they're waking up, and they're not supposed to be waking up, and they're in this sort of suspended state of uncertainty of what their future is, and when it's going to be over and when it's going to happen. And so he wrote to this moment and where we all are. And like the end of the piece is when all this is over, I'm going to dot, dot, dot. And it's this repeated sung motif at the end of the piece. And it just felt really like so emotional for this moment. And I was grateful for that connection to that the uncertainty that we're all experiencing and how we feel in that, the vulnerability of that space.
Thanks. That's clear. I really love that. It's great talking with you about this. I wanted to also ask, because this is, you know, so critical in this time, about funding. Obviously, here has continued to be funded. I know that's a struggle as other institutions are struggling, but you've increased funding for the arts and artists, and you're taking on, you know, very ambitious things. You know, working on the whole production of something with an artist and all this support. I know how complex that is. And so what I want to ask is, how is the landscape for fundraising? It seems that here and yourself have been successful, that there is support for the art, that and you know, I may be mistaken here, but that you're able to still, you know, continue your mission and even thrive in this environment.
Well, we have really struggled. We have made very strategic choices. We were successful at getting one of the PPP funds from the government back last year. That was good for 8 weeks. And so that got us from basically to the end of June. And then in June, we had to put our whole staff onto the shared work program. And we had some staff on family leave and some staff on they had to step away for different things. So I did not want to lay the staff off. I wanted to keep the staff intact. So we put everybody on shared work, including me and the other, my two like right-hand folks, Meredith Shade and Brenna Thomas. And all of us are working 3 days a week and then collecting 2 days of unemployment. And if there's federal benefits at that time, the federal benefits as well. So it's been a creative solution for how we've gotten our staff through this process and trying to keep them financially whole at the same time as we're keeping our programming going and making sure that money is being directed to artists, because we are an arts organization and it wouldn't be ethical in my view to just pay staff and not be paying artists throughout this process. So
yeah, it seems like you're unusually on top of that. You know, the fact that artists are getting paid for all the things you mentioned is something that's also forward thinking that I applaud, of course. But also the raising of funds to do that is an ongoing, critical, and difficult task, which it sounds like you're able to keep pursuing even in these times, that funders haven't been running away is kind of what I'm getting at, that there's still funding out there, it seems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely think that there's been some support there's been some really important support. There was the fund that was put together by a number of foundations at the beginning, and we were lucky enough to receive that support from it was a bunch of different funders. The New York Community Trust administered it. I think it was like the COVID-19 fund, the New York City COVID-19 fund, something like that. But, you know, we received a generous grant from that, and we allocated a huge portion of that to go towards paying artists. We got the government help, but we have struggled. Our board stepped up big, and they gave us extra funding on top of what they normally do, and they matched donations from individuals. So that really helped. You know, we've just pieced it together bit by bit, and it is we're right now struggling to look at when we can bring the staff back on full time as we look towards opening our doors, hopefully in person in September, with some outdoor programming over the summer.
Well, that's exciting. Thanks for sharing all that with me, and also for continuing the important work that HERE is doing. I have one more question to ask, which is, what are you reading at the moment?
I'm reading Octavia's Brood. Octavia Butler is a favorite writer of mine. And this Octavia's Brood is a collection that Adrienne Marie Brown and I'm blanking who the other person is, put together of short stories. And it's really fantastic. I'm most of the way through it, but it's really great. I highly recommend it.
Well, thanks so much. There's also, of course, more information on this interview in text, links, and if there's something you missed, of course, like that other author, we'll get that in there, as well as any other funders if you want to mention them. But I just want to thank you so much for talking to me today. It's really been my pleasure, and thank you for the work you're doing.
Oh, it's such a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.